you are listening to Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are Tim Schaefer, Jake Elliott, and surprise guest, Kara Ellison.
Hooray!
Surprise!
Surprise! I'm here!
So Tim probably worked on one of your favorite LucasArts games, either as a designer, writer, or programmer. He is also the founder and creative director of Double Fine Productions, creator of such games as Psychonauts Brutal Legend and Broken Age, and he's currently working on Psychonauts 2.
Uh-huh.
Jake is a maker of artware, music, and games, like A Moth in Relay, We Were You, and The Penguin's Dilemma. He is also the co-founder of Cardboard Computer, where he is the writer on their first game, Kentucky Route Zero. Kara is a writer, narrative designer, and game critic. She wrote on the recently released Dishonored 2, and you should buy her book, Embed with Games.
Yeah, you should. Make me money.
Thank you all for coming on the show.
Kind of lit that up.
No problem.
I'm buying it right now.
Good. Go on Amazon.
Cool. All right, so we'll start with the writing process. So, Jake, what is your writing process like, and has it changed over the years?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. Well, parts of it, I don't know. So I'm like kind of a programmer, and I work with my art practice is kind of around software art. So I've done that in making installations that center on the computer, and then in the last several years I've been programming video games and writing video games, and so the writing process for me has always been like really in tandem with programming. So I'm always like doing some writing, and then I want the dialogue system in the game to support some weird features, so I switch over and do some programming to add that feature, and it's kind of always back and forth. Still, even after working on Kentucky Route Zero for, I don't know, what, 4 or 5 years, still going in and making changes to the dialogue system like all the time. So that part of my process has been pretty continuous, and actually I've been porting the same basic dialogue system code over several games. I used it in like 6 or 7 games before Kentucky Route Zero, and just this like basic implementation of like a multiple choice dialogue system that's kind of built around. It actually looks a lot like Twine under the hood, in terms of it being like about these nodes that you can kind of get into from different directions and carry some state between them. And in fact, I these days I write in a flavor of Twine, and like a kind of a fork of Twine's text-based kind of interface. If you were to write a Twine story just using a text editor, it would look a lot like the language that I write the dialogue for Kentucky Route Zero in.
That's really cool, because
what's changed
keep telling
a lot about it. Was that good?
I was just going to say, I keep telling like newbies to game design that Twine is really useful and like quite heavyweight in terms of design, and then they don't believe me, so it's amazing that you've just mentioned that.
Oh yeah, it's yeah. I mean, I use it for. I mean, like I said, I use the text, the kind of underlying text based representation of Twine stories as a way to write. The reason I started using it was so that I could quickly compile them into these like HTML mockups for the other people that I work with to try out playing through one of the conversations without having to like compile it into the game. But then I also use it as like a design tool if I want to do some kind of structural design of a conversation. I use it to kind of map, kind of block stuff out. And that was less a part of my process early on in Kentucky Route Zero, but lately a lot of the conversations in the game have gotten a lot more kind of structurally complex. So I've been using that a bit more.
Yeah. I mean, the song stuff you did seemed really complicated to me. How did you do the timing with that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was a lot of code involved in doing that, and a lot of like working with Ben to get all the parts of the song edited so that they could be like sequenced in different arrangements. And we used that part with the performance of that where the player's kind of like choosing the next lyrics in the song has this on-screen display that kind of follows as she's singing that looks a bit like karaoke. And we found this tool that people use to make subtitles for anime, I think, to make like fan subtitles for anime. So we used that a lot. It yields these like it's just like a nice tool for watching a video and like adding, or not watching a video, but listening to a sound clip and adding specific like text to like mapping them to specific points in time. and it generates these files that are called .ass files that I think is like, I think it's like Anime Sound Studio or something like that. These .ass files that go into Kentucky Retro.
Those anime people, they're so rude.
Yeah, it's really rude, yeah.
So you write stuff in Twine, and then do you import it into your own engine, or do you rewrite it all from scratch?
I have a little script I wrote that converts it into XML, and that's what actually gets loaded in the game. I was using just XML for many years before, but I really liked writing in XML. It's super verbose, but you can kind of see the structure a little bit visually. But you're still just, I don't like writing in writing in Twine itself with all these visual boxes. I just like to have like a text editor. So now the reason that I'm using this Twine subset is mainly just because it's less verbose. It's easier to like write and delete a bunch of stuff, which has been really important to like, you know, have like a lower barrier to feeling more comfortable throwing away a lot of stuff. I think it's really important for me. So
yeah, and you can kind of reattach stuff as well. You can delete and then reattach it and like relink it really easily, which I find really great when you're trying to swap stuff around, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Tim, what about your process? Or Jake, did you want to continue?
No, that's cool. No.
I used to always talk about how important programming background is for writers in games, and I think it's interesting because now they are these tools like Twine where you don't have to have a CS degree to kind of get the functionality of your code working, or you could have one, it wouldn't hurt, but I mean. Just being able to have the some of the implementation open to you, as well as just, you know, instead of just, there are a lot of writers who come into a project and will just write, you know, a Word document and disappear, and then there's some who hang around and actually help, you know, script it up, or and that just gives you such a different perspective on it when you're really faced with, like, you know, how long, how the pacing of what you wrote plays in the game, seeing it, and that is such an important part for me of the editing process, is like, oh my god, this cutscene is so long, going back and cutting it, or seeing how the way I wrote it is going to require, like, I could write a line of dialogue that would just mandate three new engine features, and I could go, well, maybe, let me just change this one line, so we don't have to do those. So being able to have a little bit of an idea of how things are implemented, or having to implement them yourself in the game really helps, and I think those new tools like Twine let you do that, you know, offline outside of the game, and then and test it out. So when you're delivering something, it's much more usable.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I feel like that's where this sort of design aspect comes in. When people talk about narrative designer, they never really know what you actually mean, which is interesting. So I think it's kind of cool that you can kind of bring that sort of design in as being a thing where it's more about I guess, testing and iterating more than it was ever before, which is much more useful, I think, for me as a writer. I think actually, Tim, you said to me one time on Twitter, you said that writing for games is a really good kind of way to become more concise as a writer, and I definitely needed that. So yeah, I did a lot of stuff in Twine where I just became a more concise person because I was really tired of my own, you know, wordiness getting in my way, you know?
It does. It's ruthless and it's cruel. Like, I used to hear talks by writers, novelists, who would say, you know, I think everyone should work in journalism for a few years because it works the fat off your prose style. Mm-hmm. And I would say, oh, I got to work the fat off my prose style. That sounds great. But games, you know, when we were first testing in Monkey Island, we'd watch people playing the game. And after three lines of dialogue went by, we'd see their hand tapping the mouse, tap, 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 like, ugh, I can't wait to start clicking again. And we had to make these rules, like no more than three lines of dialogue in a row. And it was hard because we just write these expansive, beautiful scenes, we thought, and then we were told, I mean, in the old days, it would be like something for disk space storage. It would be like, there's too much text. Wow. The text is filling up the disks. Wow. We're going to have to add another floppy, and so you'd have to go and cut the dialogue down by like 30%. But then, you know, I was, you know, just out of school, and I was offended by this idea of cutting all this beautiful dialogue. And then the first time I was like dragged, kicking and screaming through the process, I was like, oh, so this is what writing is. Oh, I get it. This is so much better. Everything that was there when I was done is like, that's so much better. I can't believe I almost didn't cut that.
Does it get easier to, Tim, does it get easier to kill all your darlings? Is it when you're editing?
I feel like. It is easier, but it's you have to be reminded to do it. Like, we're doing this VR game, the Psychonauts VR game, and so many things are more boring in VR than they are in a regular game. Where, like, your head is moving around. Like, you'll look at an object, and normally in an adventure game, you get to have someone talk about that object for a while. But the person's already whipped their head around. They're looking at something else, and you're still talking about the glass, and they're looking at the window, and they're really confused while you're talking about it, holding water. And, like, anyway, so this just happened on our second last game, and I've written all these scenes, and I'm like, we're running out of, you know, animator time. You know, these cutscenes are really long. And I'm like, let me look at the scene, see if they can be any shorter. And each scene, I was just really quickly able to cut in half. And I was like, I find it much easier to be cruel to my own writing now. Because I'm like, yeah, I don't know what I was thinking when I wrote this scene. Let me just cut this all out. And it's just like a discipline thing to be reminded. Sometimes it takes outside forces to remind you that you should really go back over everything you've written and try to cut it in half, and you'll feel much better afterwards.
And I find, like, Twine is a really great thing to write in because it forces you to think almost like in poetry, like in verse, because when you actually see where the text lies on the screen, it's much nicer if you get it to center itself. And then if it's centered in the middle of the screen, then you want it to, like, visually look up a particular way. So actually, like, kind of poetry or verse actually works really, really amazingly in Twine, which forces you to be concise, obviously, as well. And I feel like that's a kind of a strength in Kentucky Write Zero as well. Is like you, it's almost like poetry that you write, Jake. It's like really amazing, kind of dreamlike poetry, I guess.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I like looking at the text visually also. And we used before even we were using Twine, we had a little script that turned every conversation into a flowchart with these nodes just named without seeing any of the actual text, so we could look at a conversation and, you know, if, like, it might look interesting from just looking at it as text, but then if it looks boring in this other way, maybe that triggers an edit, you know?
You've just taken all of the romance out of it. A flowchart? How dare you?
No, like a romantic flowchart.
With love hearts on it.
With black arrows pointing from...
Little arrows.
Boxes with rounded corners.
You guys don't make flowcharts before you go on a date? Is that not... We just make it up on the spot?
I can only go on a date with a flowchart. Like, that's my... But yeah, no, I think it's... And I really like how, so for me, when I work with Twine in particular, I find that the transitions are something that really changes the mood of, like, the story that you're making. Like, the idea that, you know, the text takes the time to actually appear in Kentucky Write Zero. Like, it actually creates this kind of, you know, dreamlike kind of wandering feeling. And that's really hard to do, actually. I find transitions very difficult to kind of judge. And so how did you come about kind of doing that?
Doing the visualization of, like, the text, like the visual treatment
of
the text?
You know, so, you know, when it appears, it's often quite slow and it'll take some time to actually appear one by one, you know?
I guess, like, in a lot of games, but, like, in Japanese role-playing games, often we see the text kind of, like, gets fed out in these, like, single, paragraph blocks, and it sort of, like, reads out, and they use stuff like, they kind of overuse ellipses to, like, break up the text, you know, and you have a lot of times
like, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, a character just says dot. Yeah, exactly, like that. You know, so I think there is like a lot of precedent in video games for working with text as like a real time, you know, quantity, as like a real time form. And so we've been playing with that. We have a sort of map somewhere in the dialogue system that says this kind of punctuation adds this amount of delay. You know, so commas delay for a little while and periods delay for a longer while and three periods in a row is an ellipsis, so it kind of pauses for a while. So we kind of write thinking about that kind of real-time revelation of the text as having like a rhythm.
Why did you do that? Like, what effect did you want it to create?
I don't know, like pacing and to feel, you know, just to give it a rhythm, you know, so that it didn't feel like you're getting access to like a database or something, like you're looking at notes or something, but to feel like it had like it was happening in real time, because it is happening in real time, you know?
So like this, the speed of talking normally, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or the speed of talking dramatically, if not realistically, you know?
Okay.
This, the speed of like an actor giving a delivering a line or something. And we had to, we started working on this game, and it was we were using Unity, and it was like Unity 2.0 something or something. It was like a really old, it was a while ago, so it was an early version of Unity, and they didn't support, at that time, their text system didn't support stuff like bold or italics or whatever. This kind of text formatting wasn't part of the library at that point. So we had to implement that ourselves. So we built this kind of like really weird hacky system that's about overlaying different blocks of text that have different treatments on them, and we had to write shaders for this text and all this stuff. This is just to say that we have this like really materialistic kind of implementation of text in the game. That we kind of had to roll ourselves a lot. So that our thinking about the text has always been, you know, very, very kind of materialistic, and we've always been thinking about it as a kind of like programmed real time, you know, kind of object and it within the game. So like another side effect of that was that, you know, we can have a bold or an italics layer, but we can also have a layer that has some weird shader that makes it look like clouds are passing over certain words of the text or something. So, or we have another layer that makes it look like the text is coming across on a computer, and we can kind of mix them all in there. So the text is really, the typography is really alive and happening in real time for us in the game.
Mm, cool. And so how do you both, like, and I guess Nick and Max as well, I was wondering how you, like, are you structuralists? Do you sit down, you mentioned the flowchart, but do you sit down and, like, plan from the beginning, like, absolutely everything? Or do you start just writing scenes that you like?
I am, like, when I'm looking at a whole game from the beginning, I'm totally a structuralist, I guess. Like, just dating back to when I was first starting out, and I read that Sid Field screenplay book. Has anyone read that book?
Oh, yes. God, don't even. Get it away from me.
It's super short, and it helped me like get some real basics down. And then I would like, it just made me start thinking about this thing as a timeline in my notebook, and I would just keep writing that timeline down over and over again, and where plot points were, and where different things would happen, and what where characters would come and enter. And I would think about that at a real high level over and over again. And then after that, and then it gets more into, well... Yeah, so I do start with a lot of structure at first.
And you probably have to also, because you work on a team, right? Tim, is that...
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to write a shared document where I'm showing everybody, like, this is where all the levels go in this, you know, and this is, that plot, you know, helps inform where the levels go and stuff like that. So I'll be sharing a lot of that with the team, too. But now tell me why you hate that book.
Well, I mean, I feel like people often, it's very useful as a tool, but I feel like people often adhere to those structures to, like, you know, they're really aggressively adhering to it in a way that it sometimes isn't productive. You know, like when you get down to it, people who've read like all of these different, you know, like act structures, and they think they know exactly where everything goes, and then you try to be a little bit more experimental or flexible with it, and sometimes it makes them like really unsettled by it.
Yeah.
And I feel like that sometimes is like not particularly useful, but in other ways, obviously, it's a really good model. But yeah, there are other stories that you can tell that are slightly outside of that model as well. So yeah, like I'm sure Jake probably has something to say about it, but it's interesting to me that like it's become like such a, you know, it is a useful tool, but it's just a tool. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I mean, such a vague structure. It's just like three acts. I mean, there's it does have a lot of flexibility within that, and I'm the big I get bothered by people who really rush to a certain sort of structure. Either like I've always been a kind of, one of my pet peeves is the hero's journey, and people are always talking about the hero's journey, because I'm like, you guys, this is just one bag of tricks that works. This is like, you don't have to have this, you know, this exact, you know, that idea that like every single story fits on this circle, and you can, because Star Wars does, and therefore every single movie ever written fits on it. And I'm like, well, part of that is like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like every screenwriter learns this story, and so they're trying to make their stories fit on this wheel. But there's a lot of stories, I think, like you said, that don't fit on that wheel at all.
Exactly. And sometimes I feel like, you know, especially when you're working on something that is supposed to be typical hero's journey, you kind of find yourself wanting to kind of break out of that mold a little bit, because it is very kind of Hollywood and it feels very kind of worn, you know, in some respects. And I often feel like, I feel like a teenager, like raging around the house going, why can't I do what I want with this, you know? And and it's just one of those things where, you know, people accuse you maybe sometimes of being like really stuck up or like too like avant-garde or whatever, or like being like this like kind of typical writer figure. And I don't want to be that kind of like annoying, egotistical type. I just kind of want to do interesting work, you know?
Yeah,
I think it's helpful just when you're starting out. I mean, starting on any project, and you're just in that, like, there's nothing, you're just in a sea of nothingness, and you're like, where do I start? You're like, well, okay, let's start with a couple of rules. Do I have anything, you know? Sometimes it's just helpful to, like...
Absolutely, yeah. It is useful, and I think as long as you've got that structure down first, and then you can start messing around with it, which is my favorite part.
Mm-hmm. I've only just heard about people making fun of the Save the Cat book. I've never heard of that book until just now.
Do you guys know? Oh, it's terrible.
Oh, I've never heard
of it. Don't read that book.
So we all saw, went as a team to go see Doctor Strange because it's kind of psychonautical. Oh, God, we got to stop saying psychonazi. Psychonautical. And everyone liked it. Everyone was like, it was really good. And one was like, it's a little Save the Cat-ish. And I was like, what does that mean? He's like, oh, just... there's this one book that is the reason why all movies made today are exactly the same. It's like this. It's like it makes screenplay look like a. It looks like it makes a Sid Field book look like a super nuanced.
Yeah.
Because I guess it's just like a really formulaic approach to writing a screenplay that every single Hollywood film has been doing.
It tells you like you should do this by page, this by page, this, and all this stuff, and.
So people have these rules that they like, and you know, on page 60, you have to have something really wacky happen. And they'll be like, you don't have to do that. It's just that usually it's like someone who is outsider, who's not an experienced writer. It seems like magic in the same way that to me, someone who can play music or paint seems like magic to me. And so when you learn a rule, you're like, oh, that's how they're doing it. They got these rules that they're using, you know? And so it's so, oh, I'm going to stick to all these rules, and I'm going to have my Prometheus character be shackled on this act. And that's how you do it. You just follow these steps. And the truth is, those are like a bag of tricks. Like, those are things you can grab that often do work, but there aren't these rules to it at all.
Yeah. I totally feel the same way, for sure. And I think, I don't know, it's one of those things where I feel like some people can sit down and watch a movie and then they know what the twist is immediately. I'm not that kind of person because I get so invested in scenes, because if the scenes are good, I forget about the bigger structure. I often think scenes are good when characters have ownership over the space they're in. And, you know, they feel like they're either at odds with the space or they're either, you know, comfortable in the space. And it's about like what characters are comfortable where. And I really get invested in that. So I kind of get lost in those parts because they're my favorite parts of writing. And then I can never see the twist coming. So, yeah, I'm one of those types that is not a structuralist at all, because I just don't look at that big picture. But I guess maybe slowly I am becoming that because I work in games and it's kind of impossible not to think that way almost, because you do think in flowcharts, I guess, eventually.
Jake, how long did it take you to settle on the Kentucky Route Zero structure?
Well, we had this like... this kind of layout for the plot, I guess, of the game, or this kind of list of sequence of things that happen and places and people, and that's remained like largely unchanged since the beginning of the project. But it feels very different to me now, because you know, once you I just feel like I can't really understand anything creatively until I'm working on it, you know. Like I can pretend to outline it or pretend to plan about it, but it really doesn't exist, you know, until I'm like in there working on it. So we're still hitting these kind of plot points that we had imagined in the beginning, but they have a completely different meaning to me at this point. They feel totally foreign to what I wrote in this email to Tomas that I wrote several years to my partner Tomas several years ago when we were planning this project, where I outlined, you know, what was going to happen in the game. We decided to use this kind of five act structure, which again is sort of, you know, like the screenplay outline or whatever, is like is an old form that has, you know, these like five acts with, you know, it's like from ancient Greek theater or whatever.
Shakespeare. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, yeah. So we're using that, but basically, and we're kind of, I don't know, I kind of use these structures as like a filing system for ideas. Like, I was mentioning to Carr, we do a lot of research all the time, and that's a big part of our process, is just doing all this research and talking about it and mining research for as many kind of different ideas and directions as we can, and trying to stuff them all into the game and just kind of like file them in these different scenes, you know.
And you made a literal filing cabinet as well in the game.
Oh yeah, yeah, there's a filing cabinet there.
Of all the game designers. Is
yeah,
Tim
right.
in there, or is it a huge insult that you forgot?
Oh, God. Well, probably. I have to look at it again. It was like 5 years ago.
You have a binder full of men?
Binders of women. I was just going to say that. It was like a binder's full of
game designers.
Yeah.
Wait, what are you making this creepy folder for? Is it about collecting souls?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You'll all be the first to go, basically.
Since we're still on structure...
Yeah.
This is for all of you, but Tim, I found this in an interview of yours where you talked about you feel like you're a different person at different stages of writing, and you're serious when designing the arc of a story, but then when you dial down into specifics and like the dialogue, you become goofier. Why do you think that is? And then for Kara and Jake, do you have similar mood shifts when you're arcing something out versus dialing down?
That's interesting. As you were saying that, I was like, yeah, I do that. I wonder if I should do that, and what would happen if I didn't do that? But I think... It does. Every time I'm pitching a game, people are like I was pitching Grim Fandango, they're like, this is a really serious sounding, boring game. Like, they're like, is this a tragedy or what? And I was like, no, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? And a lot of the games I pitch, they sound really serious on a high level. And then when I go to write the scene, because the scene to me is, at least for me, like, I think about the structure and then I think about the characters and go really deep in their backstory. So I feel like I know them all really well. And then when I go to write the scene, it feels like this multiple, like, split personality improv scene where I'm doing all this acting myself and I'm just kind of writing and acting and blah, and improvising. And I think it leads to, it feels a little bit more like the performance, and that tends to get a little bit more hammy, like hamming it up, like I'm on stage, I guess, a little bit more, because I'm actually imagining the characters performing these things. And so maybe that's why it happens. I don't know if it should happen, because it would be funny to think of a structure where I was just sitting there trying to ham it up and lighten up about it. But I guess because when I'm doing structure stuff, I feel like I'm problem solving. I'm figuring out, okay, how do I link these two things together? How do I get from this scene to this scene? And how do I make this character motivated to do this? And so I'm doing all these, like, just answering all these problems. And then when I'm actually writing the scene, it's more an like this thing that's been coiled up this whole time is just exploding out and gets a little goofy.
And you've given yourself like a free open space to improvise because you've already done all this problem solving work. Right.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's like with improv theater, people who do these amazing things like improvise an entire Shakespeare play and it feels very convincing. And it's like, that's, you know, they're able to do that because of all, there's such a like a thoroughly studied body of work where it's like really possible to, you know, like to improvise.
Yeah, Shakespeare is also like a really strict structuralist, so you can work within those boundaries because you know what every scene is like supposed to do. You know, it's like a loaded gun. Yeah. You just have to fire it in a particular way. So
do you guys feel that you're very different with that, as different than what I was saying?
I feel like I'm similar because I often find that it's very difficult to pitch a story because it's not... That's why treatments are good, right? Because treatments can be evocative because you can include dialogue and, like, you know, you can set the scene and you can use, like, evocative language. But when you've just written a three-act structure that's literally just dry plot because you're solving all of those problems, when someone sees that story from a high level, it seems boring and devoid of any emotion whatsoever. And I find that that's the biggest problem is when people kind of look at that and that's the thing that you're presenting, they always find it really dull. And it's like, well, the reality is that if you summed up like Star Wars, it would be a really dull story if you looked at it from a very high level. And then all of the fun comes in the fact that Harrison Ford has basically improvised all his lines. You know what I mean? So yeah, it's an interesting one.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I'm undermining myself a lot in the actual writing. I'm undermining my planning self a lot. Like I tell Tomas and Ben that I'm like, this is going to happen. And then I get in there and write it. And like these events totally don't happen in the writing. And then I go back and I say, well, actually, it went this other direction. And it feels kind of weird to say that. Like it went this other direction. Like I had, you know, but what's that?
I tried. Yeah. Certain things.
Yeah. It's sort of silly, but once I get in there, I'm sort of, improvising. And maybe some of those ideas that we talked about are guiding it in some way, or maybe I'm trying them out and discarding them.
Do you guys ever read Breakfast of Champions, the Kurt Vonnegut book? And he shows up at the end, and he's one of the characters, and he's like, I can't totally control where the scenes are going or where these characters are going, but I can pull on them with these brittle rubber bands. Mm. And he just talks about, and I feel that way a lot when I'm writing a scene, like I can pull on the characters with brittle rubber bands, but I can't make them do exactly what I want.
I remember reading Stephen King's On Writing, which is one of my favorite books on writing, like at all. And it's an incredible book because I remember like punching the air when he said that he often starts writing stories without knowing what the ending is. He just creates a bad situation and then puts his characters in it. And then because of the people that the characters are, he then like is led by them towards a particular ending. And that's how I used to start out writing before I knew about Sid Field. I used to start out writing thinking, okay, what's a cool opening and then a terrible situation? And then how do I torture my characters until an obvious ending, right? And it used to be that way with me, particularly with just like prose and, you know, fiction novel, that kind of stuff. And now like I always think in terms of structure. So I often remember like the feeling I had when I felt like vindicated that I'd be doing something okay. But at the same time, I don't think everyone wants to become, you know, that kind of writer. So yeah.
Well, definitely there's always a point where I can get to, like I'm trying to solve this puzzle to put the game, you know, putting the game or the story structure together. And at a certain point, I often like work myself into like this unsolvable state and just walk away from it. Like back when I was taking a screenwriting class and writing screenplays, I'd get into this like place where I'd written myself into a corner and like, I don't know how to solve any of these problems. And then so thinking about structure to the point where it actually becomes really inhibited. I mean, that's where it's really negative, you know, as opposed to just helping out in the beginning where it's just like, I got to start with something. I mean, it sounds, I think people often will think of games as being these really, or, you know, we do something really creative that it's all just fluffy and dreamlike the whole time. But, you know, often I start, I mean, the first thing I did when I was doing Grim Fandango was like math. Like I was like, how many puzzles were in Full Throttle? I need to double that. Okay, I need 80 puzzles. And I just started to, like just approaching it mathematically just, so I think of it a little bit like, you know, like, some sort of brutalist architecture. Like a lot of times you'd see these like cement buildings or like an old Bauhaus like architecture drawing and it looks like just a cube and you're like, this seems so anti-human. But then when you see people in it, you see people actually using the space, you realize the people are like, they provide the round edges and all the heart and all the interesting things and the background, the building kind of, you know, is a stage for them. And I feel that way about structure. Like it seems really cold and mathematical that you put these three acts in there, but then it's all the softer bits that you add in there that add the originality and the flavor and the personality of the piece.
Yeah, I remember someone calling it a possibility space, which is I think what games are. You know, they provide a space for something to, you know, be possible, and you as a designer kind of create the things that are specifically possible within that space. But with like, you know, script writing and stuff, it's just exactly the same. It's like you put two characters in a space and then the audience can technically see what's possible to happen in that space. And then you let the characters work that out interestingly or the most interesting way you can kind of fathom. I mean, Tim does it you know, by having someone wave, you know, balloons at something for 3 hours, which is what I did at Grim Fandango. No, I mean, I really love the waving the balloon thing. Like, that one action amused me for, like, hours and hours because I was just really amused by the fact that there was a balloon shaped like a man smoking a pipe and I would just go and like wave it at stuff. That was like incredible. And a very good soundtrack to go with it too. But yeah, like I think it's one of those things where you create a space in which like in a number of interesting things can happen and like the audience has so much like enjoyment out of like figuring out all of those possibilities. And I think that's like the most enjoyable part of being a writer is just like figuring out all of the shit that can go wrong and all of the cool stuff that can go right.
Tim, how long is it for like your games? Has the structuring taken pretty much the same amount of time or has it changed a lot?
Gosh, I don't know if that's really changed that much. I mean, there are other people involved a lot more. You know, we're talking about what works for, you know, with adventure games, they can be so much more narrative driven, you know, and then the puzzles fit in differently. But for, you know, once you get into games that have more systemic features and more like something like combat or weapons, then it's like, okay, this guy can't give you this weapon on this level because you need to have it earlier, and so he doesn't, you know, it's just like there's a lot more interaction with the game's features and the structure, so you have a whole team of people working on it with you even from the earliest structural days.
And I have a more general question for all of you. What tools in like the storytelling toolbox do you feel are underutilized and overutilized in video games today?
Yeah, I have trouble answering that. Because I don't feel like I have that much of a connection. You mean tools like, maybe I'm misunderstanding. I was thinking about tools like as a writer, like tools how like process tools. But maybe you're talking about storytelling tools, like kind of.
Yeah.
You're not talking about Google Docs.
No, I know that. Yeah. I get it. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I'm going to say because I said it last time I was on the podcast, but like Brandon Chung's jump cuts, is that what it's called? No, smash cuts. It's called smash cut. And his use of smash cut is so hugely underused in games, and it's an incredibly powerful thing to move a player physically into a different space immediately, or to even move them into a different time. You know, same place, different time is really, really powerful. And it's not used very often. And it was used actually really dramatically in Uncharted 4, where you got that amazing, what you'd call a match cut in film terms, where you're underwater, you know, he escapes a prison and he jumps into the water. And then suddenly it kind of dissolves into like years later when he's scuba diving a wreck, I think. And it's just really powerful, and it's never used. And I guess it's because we don't really think in those terms with games much.
Yeah, and that Game Virginia came out recently, used it a lot, and they said in their credits, like, they were really inspired by 30 Flights of Loving, and this was, and I was thinking when I was playing Virginia, like, you know, I thought immediately of Brendan's work, and also, like, this could be a whole genre, this technique could support a lot more, you know, exploration.
I mean, I guess Virginia did, but, like, I always thought, God, someone should just steal that wholesale and make a whole series of games that are just the smash cut angle because they're so interesting, you know. I think I first encountered it in Half-Life 1 where it you know, right at the time that the whole lab explodes, or you make the lab explode, you kind of are like you're moved into like either the future or like somewhere on Zen by accident, and that's kind of that was the first time I think I encountered it, really.
Right.
I think you might see more of it in VR, just a little bit, because navigation is so hard. I think people are teleporting around a lot. But changing time periods and stuff is a little more. But I think all kinds of dramatic cuts, I think, are going to become more popular in VR, because you can't really move the camera around.
That sounds cool.
I just always thought that it was because, like, particularly big budget games are always, like, really leery of actually removing control from the player because they think that that's horrible and a bad thing and, like, control is what players want. But the more I work in games, the more I realize that players, A, usually don't know what they want and like, and B, they are actually, it's not control they want. They want to be able to feel I don't know, somehow they want to feel triumphant somehow, and that's not always achieved through control necessarily. So yeah, it's an interesting one.
Tim, do you have any thoughts?
I like those answers. I was going to just try and add to those with mine. But I'm trying to think of any other, I swear if you actually started looking at a game, I'd be like, oh yeah, that's used way too much.
Then I have a side question, because on your Wikipedia page, it says that in an interview in 2003, you said you had a goal of creating a game without any cutscenes at all. Has that changed?
I always struggle with that, because my natural tendency is just someone who's, you know, written non-game stuff or tried to. It's so much easier to like just get going sometimes with a scene and forget that the player wants to get involved once in a while and play the game. And so like in the old, like with ever since the first game, just trying to cut the cutscenes down, I guess it just puts in this the thing that Carl was just talking about, that feeling of like it's really bad to take control away from the player. More, I've kind of internalized that just because of my constant struggle against my own tendency to write too much, you know. And so it's like the other part of my, I've been abused by this other part of my brain, which is always trying to get me to cut stuff down.
Yeah.
But I mean, we did, I guess with Broken Age, it's the first time I was like, okay, there's going to be no opening cutscene. So there's no opening cutscene to that game. So I'll just say, yeah, we totally did it. I'm done with that quest.
Costume Quest is almost devoid of cutscenes. It just has that beginning bit, maybe.
Did you skip all the cutscenes? Is that what you're saying?
Maybe I skipped all the cutscenes. Or maybe I got stuck. Actually, I got stuck for ages in Costume Quest, and it's a kid's game, and I was like, oh, shit. You're an idiot, Kara. But yeah.
This is more for Tim and Jake. Since both of you have talked about the importance of voiceover, either in having or not having it, why is that important for you to not have voiceover or have voiceover in your games?
For me, it's something I really want to explore more, but it's very different from the kind of writing that I've been doing in KRZ so far, which, like I was, Kara and I were talking about earlier, like the writing in KRZ now is really treats text in a very material way. So in addition to like exercising some, for me, very interesting control over the pacing, you know, at which the text is revealed, there's also stuff where a lot of the text is getting kind of reconfigured according to things that have happened in the game before, or momentary choices by the player, or even like kind of not randomly but chaotically, some of the sentences are getting rewritten and rearranged and stuff. Especially in the fourth episode of the game, there's a lot of stuff in there that is really chaotic. Things people say are different for every player. And that stuff would be, I think, practically impossible to do if I had to record those lines. So that's some stuff that I'm just, you know, really enjoying exploring that kind of precludes me from working with voice in the game. But that said, we did use a voice actor for the last interlude that we worked on Here and There Along the Echo, which was the one where you call up a phone system. And we had Will Oldham do the voice acting for this automated tourism information system. And that was like a really amazing experience for me working with a voice actor there, because I could kind of write the script and then hear him perform the script and then edit the script. And I only got to do a little bit of that because I didn't plan to edit in response to the performance, because I didn't know it was going to be such a source of insight into things that needed to change in the script or that I wanted to change. But, you know, like having somebody not just like I sometimes have my wife or somebody read stuff back to me that I've written just to hear how it sounds to her. And that's always like really useful. And I wish I should do more of that. But it's whenever I do it, I'm like really glad that I did it. But having somebody who's like an actor do that is like huge. Like I really get a lot of insight into what the language is doing when I have an actor do it. And I'd really love to pursue creative relationships with an actor that are even more kind of closely involved. Something like what the filmmaker Mike Lee does, where we have the actors improvise according to a structure and then go back and forth editing and improvising and editing. That would be like really, so that's something I'm really interested in exploring. But yeah, I really value the performance aspect of what actors and voice actors do. But for KRZ, because of the materiality of the text, it doesn't quite fit there.
Makes sense. Tim?
I've done it for a long time. It's I think it's we've made games without it too, and I feel like it's the upside from I mean, it complicates things a lot, and it really locks you in. It's been this way for so long that a lot of, I mean, you know, it seems so natural. But in the old days, we could change dialogue like a day before we shipped.
Yeah, right.
And it was crazy. And now in the days we lock things way in advance so that it can be localized for other, and also so it can be voice recorded. But it does. I think everything that Jake was just saying about collaborating with that person is one of the most rewarding things. I mean, it's just like any creative person on your project. You're coming together, and they're adding a lot to your work. They're taking it and giving it a whole different life that, you know, a lot of dialogue might not have had before they came to it. And a lot of times I do get in that studio and have that same feeling of like, you know, having so much fun working back and forth with this really skilled artist who's a performer and is asking me questions about the character that I hadn't thought of before, and they're asking why they say these things, and then they're like, they're trying different angles. They're like, what if I do this? What if I do this? And you're like, man, that would be so fun to just start a project with these guys. Mm-hmm. And actually, like, what if these people were involved in the very early days of creating a character? I feel like that would be a really fun way to involve them. But they're just part of the, you know, the great thing about games being that you work with so many different disciplines, you know, musicians, right, and writers and actors and programmers and engineers and animators. Just like you get to work with all, you know, almost everybody. So actors are just a whole class of fun people to collaborate with.
Right. Yeah. Bring another form to the super hybrid form already. I was thinking about Tim working with voice actors and not, I just remembered like sense of betrayal that I felt moving from Monkey Island 1 and 2 to Monkey Island 3 because of the voices, you know, which were really good. And I went back and played Monkey Island 3 again recently, and I do like them, but a lot of the kind of humor at first didn't land for me when there were voice actors. And I think there's like different kinds of writing that works better in text.
Mm-hmm.
Than with voice,
and when your imagination is filling in what the characters sound like,
it's also
not as obvious if a joke isn't working. Like if someone just is reading and they're not laughing or something, you can't really tell if a joke's. But if someone's saying it out loud and it's just wrong, and you know, I think it's really important that for the people who write the dialogue to be in the studio to explain the occasional joke, because like oh here's what you know, because unless you're really explicit in your script, so often that if they you know, some actors do and some actors don't, you know. As far as being able to almost just to kind of get this weird psychic link with the writer, like where they just have a similar sense of humor and they see where you're coming from with whether it's jokes or whether it's something else, you know, just it's great to be just one more thing that you have to nail, you have to get right, or else the whole thing, you know, the effort you put into writing is kind of lost if it doesn't come all the way through the acting and the direction and the editing of the scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on the other hand, I can't actually imagine Full Throttle without having the voices they do, because they're so excellent. You know, Ben's voice is so iconic and, you know, so much part of that game that it's really tough to sort of think about that game just being text, I guess. Because it's like part of that landscape almost, like that, you know, the fact that he's got this like gravelly voice, and Maureen's got this very kind of pragmatic kind of voice that's very kind of low for a woman. So it's like really bikery kind of voices that were chosen for them. So I thought they were really good. And they gave this sense of like texture to what was already quite kind of evocative art. So yeah, I know I really enjoyed the voice acting in that game. I thought it was great.
That's awesome. Yeah, it is one thing that could be a huge boon to a game, but it's one more opportunity to collaborate and one more opportunity to mess up. And I also felt weird about Monkey 3, just on the record. Just wasn't quite how I imagined it, but...
Question for all of you. Has what you respond to or are looking for in a game narrative changed over the years?
Yeah, because I never thought something like Kentucky Route Zero was ever going to exist. I always thought that games were going to be, you know, I feel like it's a different form of the adventure game. It makes sense that it exists now that I've played it, but when I played adventure games when I was very young, I never imagined that they could be almost like it's such an ambiguous way to go about story, and it's much more like almost participating in a novel than it is like, you know, because a lot of options in adventure games have very specific kind of uses. It's almost like you're using the text to solve the puzzle or using the text to get somewhere. Whereas in Kentucky Route Zero, you are doing that, but it's not explicit what's really supposed to happen. And it's not particularly obvious where it's going to lead, if anywhere, and if it's making any difference even. And I feel like I never thought that was going to happen when I was younger. And so now I'm kind of really consciously waiting for the next Kentucky Route Zero because it's leading somewhere that I've never been before. And that's so exciting, you know, that it's exciting to go there. Whereas, I feel like if I play Grim Fandango, for example, I feel like I'm being transported back to an era where like I did just want like goofs and I still want goofs. I think there's a kind of two sets of things going on there where like there's a one is like, you know, set up and knock them down, and the other one is kind of almost like exploration of text, which I think is really interesting. And I've really embarrassingly just used both of your games as examples. Sorry.
Well done. That was really good. Now we both owe you.
That was so embarrassing. I shouldn't have done that. But never mind. Let's move on.
we're working in the context of all the new experimentation and game narratives and stuff that's happened over the last 15 years with interactive fiction and with Twine and stuff. So especially, I mean, it's accelerated in the last maybe 6 years or something, but even before that, the kind of text adventure renaissance from the late 90s, with like Andrew Plotkin and folks like that, was a big shift in what game narratives were about and what they were like. You know, like the text adventure Violet, where you're, you know, thinking about finishing your thesis and thinking about your girlfriend that you're having a fight with, or whatever. You know, these kind of like narrative spaces that were really, you know, like compared to something like Planetfall or something, text adventures from the 80s. It's just like, yeah, the possibility space is really, or the space of like what's reasonable to expect from a game is really shifted. So yeah, I'm definitely in a Twine world now. Definitely look for different things in games.
I often feel like, and you mentioned Andrew Plotkin, I often feel like people should be ripping off Andrew Plotkin's Spider and Web more often.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's an amazing,
just
an
incredible piece of work. And every time I sit down to play it, I think, how have people not, like, every time I play it, just like, oh, I'm like, oh god, like I want to make like an actual visual version of this. How could we do that? And I think about it all the time, but it's so old now, and it's like one of those things where, you know, I often think I haven't really changed in my tastes. I've just kind of explored things that already exist and like was surprised exist, I guess, because people were doing these like text adventures like way back. Like I was playing them on the BBC. That was like my first game, was like one of those parser text adventures. And that kind of made me want to read. So really, video games are responsible for me becoming a writer almost, which is kind of a dreadful charge to lay. But it's kind of one of those things where I just because those things already kind of existed. It's not that anything especially new is being done, because I don't even think that there's things about VR that are like incredibly new per se, you know?
Tim, do you have an answer?
I'm trying to put my head in the space where usually I have this weird mental space where I feel like I go into every game like just kind of accepting, you know, like, I don't want to say I accept it without any sort of, a lot of games, I guess I don't expect every game I play to be really, I do have some low expectations for writing games, I guess. After playing a lot of games, I'm really not like expecting to have the writing be what blows me away in most games when I play, because a lot of them are not that's not where they put the love a lot of times, or found someone who, you know. So I guess I feel like I should be looking for the games with better writing in them more deliberately. Seems like you guys have some recommendations there. I'm already writing down while you're talking.
Oh yeah, like I feel like the interactive fiction community has this all down, and we are just ignoring them because they have all the answers and we just don't ever play them, and I feel so bad about it.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, there's a huge body of that work. I've only scraped the surface of it over the years, but like I follow Emily Short's blog, and I'm always like, I'm amazed by her sort of encyclopedic knowledge of interactive fiction. Every post she makes, I find like a few new projects to check out.
Oh, but if I can, yeah, you mentioned Emily Short. If I can make a recommendation, definitely try out Sunless Sea if you haven't already. It's just, it's wonderful. It's so, like, it's so moody and like, it's a very difficult game, but it's all kind of like done in like logs. When you're on the high seas, it all kind of appears in text. And then it kind of gets printed into your ship's log. And like you look at all these like wondrous things that you're experiencing that you can only see from like, because it's like a top-down view of this little ship on the sea. And then you stop in all the ports and you go on adventures, and it's like, it's really amazing. And I really, really recommend it because Emily Short did a couple islands for that, and they're really excellent.
I've heard of that.
Tim, do you think like the types of stories you've wanted to tell over the years in games has changed?
I mean, I don't know if it's a trend, or it just seems like each time I set out to do something, I have a different idea that I thought about for a few years. I don't know if they, I mean, after doing a lot of games where the fate of the world is at stake, it does get harder to like, and the fate of the world's at stake again, like in another story. Like you do tend to like, I'm going to examine something more about interpersonal relationships. You do like, you find yourself in trying to find new things to write about, actually get smaller, I guess, smaller, not like the stakes are lower, but to, you know, try things that are not necessarily a summer action blockbuster movie type.
Well, it's like in Full Throttle, like that's just basically, oh, Mo has to inherit the family
It's like his world is at stake, though, because they're going to stop making motorcycles that he likes. So it's like the world's coming to an end, but just for him. But yeah.
Okay. I guess, but Ben isn't the important character in that game, as far as I'm concerned.
I wanted to backtrack to earlier in the podcast when Tim, you talked about working on Monkey Island and being really concise, not having more than 3 lines of dialogue. So I wanted to ask you and Jake, do you have any kind of internal writing rules now that you use?
I do. I have a lot of little, they feel more like nervous tics than writing rules, because they, but I mentioned I was working with Will Oldham to do this voice acting for our last little interlude, and one thing I noticed when working with him was I had been using punctuation in a really kind of like free form way, and like I had been using M dashes and to mean a lot of different things, and I noticed that Will had done a book on tape recently before we recorded with him, so he had just done like a ton of reading and recording his voice, and so he had like a lot of discipline about how to like read through all this text without like sort of planning or rehearsing it. So one part of that I'm sort of imagining this from, or anyway, this is my observation of him. This isn't like him talking about his process, but I noticed that he always treated punctuation to mean the same thing. So an M dash always meant move quickly onto the next word, like interrupt yourself, kind of, for example. So I, after seeing that, and it had never occurred to me that somebody would be so disciplined about interpreting punctuation, I went back and I re-edited all the dialogue in the game to give, and I kind of decided on rules of what each bit of punctuation meant as far as like how the lines would be read or something syntactically. And so now I'm really, really detail-oriented about punctuation. And I also know how the text is going to wrap, because our game uses this like fixed-width font, and we only have one font size. And so I know exactly how the text is going to wrap, and I write to that a lot, very carefully. And I started internalizing that kind of like thinking about the layout of the text when we did the second interlude that we did, which was called The Entertainment, which is this like first person, you're sitting in the audience watch, or you're sitting on stage watching a play happen. And for that one, we had the text appear, instead of appearing in these big paragraph blocks like the rest of the game, it appeared at the bottom of the screen in little subtitles. We did that because part of that piece was in VR, and we couldn't get the big block of text to look good in VR, so we just had these little subtitles that are kind of stuck to your face. And so those were really, really constrained. I think it was like 14 character line width or something. And also you would only see a maximum of two lines on screen at once. So I really had to write, I couldn't write a dangling sentence fragment that didn't make sense without, you know, the previous line on screen, or I didn't feel like I wanted to, because I didn't want people to like glance away for a minute and then come back and be completely lost in the text. So anyway, I had to write to this really narrow character width and edit all the sentences and make them so that they would fit on screen and subtitles like that in a way that, that would make sense. So that kind of stuck in my head, and I still write very carefully to the layout on screen. And I have to, I also limit the number of lines that can happen before the player clicks like next, before the player can do something.
I just like reason. To have my characters flirt. That's all I do. That's my only thing.
Like, that's a good
they
rule.
Flirt all the time. It doesn't even matter if they're attracted to each other. They just constantly flirt. They're not even interested. They're just doing it as a kind of intellectual exercise. Wow. So I actually just stop myself from doing it now. Like, I have to just stop it. But yeah, that's my final word. I gotta go now.
I feel like such an accountant now. I just talked about all these numbers and then sort of.
No. You're a filthy programmer. That's what you do.
You're saying the same thing, just with words. Making the words flirt with each other. Yeah. Wink at each other through the M dashes.
Calculating each other.
That's funny.
Kara had to duck out at this point because of a prior engagement, and I couldn't smoothly edit around it. So consider this an elegant audio segue. And now back to Tim and Jake. All right, Tim, what's your real answer?
Were you just asking for all of my rules for writing? Or a rule? All my rules.
You can
first
say
of all,
anything.
I really liked hearing Jake talk about the text, because text is such a, once you start doing a lot of voice, it's such a lost art. Like, it's like a, you know, subtitles can be like an afterthought of like, oh, we got to get subtitles, I guess, going, and we got to make sure we do it for, you know, hearing impaired and stuff like that. But it's never this, like, like you're talking about almost like someone doing hand press, like letterpress.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? Like I know some people who do that. My wife's really involved in like graphic design and letterpress and font. And like it's just a handcrafted, like printed word on the screen being such a big part of Kentucky Route Zero. So it's awesome. So I got tons of rules. I don't know. They, like a lot of like we were talking about, a lot of it is about editing, about this. A lot of it just comes from old things I saw Kurt Vonnegut say like 40 years ago. But like he talks about going through your writing and look at every single line, and if it doesn't move the plot forward or illuminate some character or do this, or you have this list of like, you know, the things that had to do, just cross it out. You know, just cross it out if it's not really doing anything. And his other thing was to like throw the first four pages or something of your story away, because like that's where you're just trying to make the audience like you. And it's just such a an interesting way to look at your own writing. Like, am I actually just right here just trying to make the audience like me? Because I think I don't need that. Like, I don't think that's gonna. And that's a hard impulse to get over sometimes, especially when you really want people to like you in general. But as a writer, just not try to impress people, not try to make people think the writer is clever, and never try to be like the star of the scene. Like, the character should be the star of the scene, never the writer, in my opinion. So,
So we'll move into puzzles, I think, right now. First for Tim, because I watched the first couple episodes of the Broken Age documentary again, and you met with a bunch of developers when you were deciding about whether you were going to have puzzles or not in Broken Age. I remember you were talking to the Cappy people, and they were saying that they didn't do it because they didn't want to break their flow.
Mm-hmm.
And so why did you end up deciding using puzzles in Broken Age?
Well, that was a big process we went through, because talking to a lot of people, and we talked about Kentucky Route Zero, and you guys had just given a GDC talk about how you don't think of them as puzzles, you think of them as mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound like you guys?
Yeah.
And, you know, we went and talking to Craig and Chris, for about Sword and Sorcery, and just a lot of these games. I understood that, like, yeah, it just kind of. Can be a big break to the flow. And people, that is one of the things that people who don't like adventure games don't like a lot, because, you know, you're having this experience and you're getting involved in the characters and the setting, and maybe that part of it's really working for you, but you just don't want to look at this puzzle because, like, they want to. And that's why we put an easy mode in Monkey Island 2. We're like, okay, some people are just going to want to flow through this and do that. But it was specific to Broken Age that we were making something that was a little retro. Like, we were promising people to return to something that they felt they had been underserved. You know, we weren't trying to make a whole new thing. We were purposely going back to the 90s for inspiration. And so that's when we decided to, have the full-on headbanging puzzles. Did I say headbanging? I guess you start ahead scratching your head and eventually banging it against them. And, you know, the model a little bit more like after Mechanurium than about than Sword and Sorcery, or, you know, something that was more, or Gone Home, that's more, it's a, the emphasis is skewed much more on the narrative side. And that's just because we were doing something for the backers of that Kickstarter project.
Yeah.
That's interesting about puzzles and flow, because I think, you know, the puzzles really are the flow. Like, they kind of are a pacing technology in so many adventure games.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just, I guess it all depends on how hard the puzzle is.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I know, yeah, getting stuck on puzzles, I've been stuck on adventure game puzzles for sure. Yeah, and I love it now. Like, I like having a puzzle worming away in my head, you know. Now, when I was a kid, it was pretty frustrating, and I called the 900 number and stuff, but now it's a nice state to be in, you know, to have it. I remember even then when when I wouldn't cheat my way through a puzzle, it would be kind of in my head, and I'd be on the school bus, and I'd be thinking about, like, well, what if I, you know, combined, what if I put the gum and the dime, whatever, you know. I mean, that's like that's a nice that it can it can live in your head.
That's a little lost with. There's so many games now. There's so much competition.
Yeah,
it's hard to like keep with a game when you're stuck on it.
Oh right, yeah.
You're moving. You're like, forget it. You know, I'm stuck on that. I'm never gonna go back and finish that. And then so much time has gone by, I've forgotten it. And I'm not gonna start over on that game. Like,
oh yeah, yeah.
It's hard, but that is a great thing, because your brain works really really hard, and then you'll go to sleep and you'll wake up and you'll know instantly the answer.
Yeah,
you dreamt about it, or you took a shower, you went for a walk, and you just got, and that's kind of a neat. That's a neat feeling.
Yeah.
When that happens.
And it works really well in Broken Age and in Day of the Tentacle, because you can switch characters and you can kind of be working actively on something while you are kind of processing the other thing in the background.
That's like one of the theories too. With we're trying with Psychonauts is that the puzzles and stuff. But if you're stuck, the idea is that the old thing, we used to let the person, you know, kind of temporarily rage quit, and then you knew they'd be back because you're the only game they could afford to buy that summer.
Yeah.
You know. And or talk their parents into buying for them. But now it's like, let them quit that activity, but keep them sucked into the game in some other mechanism. Like, keep them, now they can ride their horse around Hyrule Field and catch ghosts in bottles, even though they're stuck on this one puzzle. You know, just keep them in the game while they're, and they can have the same effect. They're going to have their brain kind of loosen up and grow and figure out its own solution.
Mm-hmm. It's a more natural kind of flow than just, I'm stuck at this puzzle, I'm going to stay in this one room until I figure it out.
Yeah, so much is just practical playtesting. Like, I really was really impressed with Limbo. The first time I played Limbo, I was like, oh, every single time I'm about to quit this game, that's the instant I figure it out. And I just don't know, are they watching me? Is this dynamic difficulty? Or, like, how are they doing this? And I asked them once, and they're like, oh, we just playtested it for years. We just, like, they just watch people play it, and they just, and that's a hard thing to do. Puzzles are hard.
Yeah. Yeah, we built one puzzle for Kentucky Route Zero, like one thing that we were like, that really felt like a puzzle. And it was right in the beginning of the game. And we thought it was a good puzzle, and we had people play it, and nobody could get past it. And it just didn't make any sense to anybody. that kind of led us not to try anything puzzly like that again. I feel like we still have a lot of stuff in the game that fulfills the same kind of function as puzzles, or meets some of the same kind of does the same kind of things that puzzles do in adventure games that I like. We have things that do pacing, you know, like we put the brakes on for the player at sometimes, which puzzles are nice for kind of breaking stuff up like that. And also, you know, puzzles give you a sense of this like real world that has rules, and, you know, has like a systemic kind of behaviors independent of you. And we do that like with, like, I don't know, one of the kind of like almost puzzles that still exists in the game is that people give you driving directions to get somewhere, and you kind of like perform the driving directions. Basically, it's not like hard, it's not like a brain tickler, but it, you do have to submit yourself to the logic of the world a little bit. So I think that kind of can help put you in the same, we think of that as a way to make the world feel like it's alive and systemic and has a behavior and it doesn't really care about you, you know.
This might be the last question, and it's particularly prescient because of Jake, you have the last act of Kentucky Route Zero coming out eventually. For both of you, is there too much What?
That's exciting.
Yeah. For both of you, is there too much pressure on conclusions? Because for like some people, the ending of a game can completely change the way they think about the however many hours that came before, especially when they have time to sit with the content for a while, like a TV show or episodic game.
Kick first.
Oh, yeah, I do think there is. I mean, I hope that we're able to, like, I hope that people like our ending, but I hope that they don't take it too, like, they don't fixate on it too much. Yeah, I don't know. It's hard, but I think a lot of the time when people get really frustrated with endings, I do kind of lay that at the feet of the designers of the game, because I think, or the film or TV series, because I think a lot of people, like a series like something like Lost or something that had a lot of people frustrated with the ending, like they really put themselves in that position by framing the whole thing as, you know, as like
a mystery
that had a solution that we were going to try to get to. And that happens a lot. That's like it's a way to build suspense, is to say that we're withholding the one piece of information that you need to unlock all of this, you know.
And do you think you've managed to avoid that by not promising that, or are you going to answer all the questions?
I hope we haven't overpromised what we're withholding. We'll see. We'll see when it comes out. I think we decided on like kind of how the game was going to end very early on, so that we could do, you know, use really basic literary techniques like foreshadowing and stuff. There's a program to it, and hopefully that'll be enough. That and the sort of like negative examples of some of these high profile situations like Lost or the Mass Effect ending that people were frustrated with or something. You know, we've been able to observe that and learn from it. But yeah, I do think there's a little bit too much emphasis on it, just because as a storytelling technique, it's, you know, like we were talking earlier about all these structures that are like these ready-made structures that can be a little bit stifling. The ready-made structure of like giving you all this information except withholding the one piece that clarifies everything until the end. That's like the kind of Sherlock Holmes murder mystery kind of approach, and it's really just one approach. You know, it's not every story has to have something like that and have a big climactic ending like that. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, endings are hard. Really, I guess, especially in adventure games, because I start to obsess over the fact that at some point the player is going to click on a verb or like click on an object, and they're going to drag it onto another object for the last time. And like, how does that one action going to summarize the entire experience for them? Like, some games end with you walking into a trigger volume. I mean, a lot of them end with you defeat a final boss, say. But, you know, it's a lot of game endings happen with these really mundane interactions. So I start to obsess about that. Like, how do I make that really exciting?
That's interesting, yeah.
Drive myself crazy with that.
Yeah. How have you, what have you done, like, as an, I'm trying to remember endings of games you've worked on specifically. Like, what, have any of those last actions really stuck out to you?
I go through, I get really, with adventure games, it's like, I go, oh my God, what have we done in the past? And I always go back to Monkey Island, because Monkey Island had this ridiculous, you're getting punched around the island all the time. And you're getting punched, and you can barely do any interactions, and it repeats and it cycles. But it's a way that we kept it, like, violent, and that there was action going on the whole time, so made it seem a little more exciting, maybe. And then I remember going totally nuts with Full Throttle, just like, just make this ridiculous, like, plane inside, truck inside of a plane going off a cliff and hanging, let's do this total Spielberg ending to it. But still in the end, the last action, I think you in the game, is you click on your bike, which maybe that's fine.
That's nice, yeah.
But I feel like I've often felt, had in my head, like, some idea of the last scene before, you know, starting on the game in some way. But not exactly. I don't know. It's hard. And I feel like I want to do better at it. Like, I feel like with this, what I'm trying to do with Psychonauts 2 is, like, you know, there's a lot of, when you're telling a story to somebody, or you're, a lot of times when people are watching a new, really high quality, serialized, like, television show, it's like, oh my God, you're not going to believe what happened last week. You know, like, that kind of feeling is so great, like, in the middle of Lost sometimes, or, like, a few of those shows, you would just be like, oh my God. And it's, maybe they killed off a character or something crazy happened, and it's like, those kind of great dramatic moments are, for some reason, it's easy to put one, the end of Act 1, and it's like, easy to put a couple more in there. But then it's easy also for the third act to just become the resolution of all that built up tension and just like letting the toy unwind.
Yeah.
And it just unwinds, that's over. And I feel like I want to make sure that all the way to the very end, those big dramatic actions by the main character are still happening. So, or not the main character or some other character, like something, some big and dramatic thing is still being enacted by some player or character's choice until the last minute of it. So it's not just like building everything up in Act 3 is just like a lighting of all the fuses and now it just blows up.
Right. That's a really good point. I'm taking notes about that right now.
This is my goal. I don't know if I'll be able to do it. No, but
that's really,
I'm trying to think of really great examples of that. But
I don't want to dish, but I can think of some negative examples of that where I just feel like the ending is just cashing checks and I'm like feeling very left out. Yeah.
Or you just know how it's going to, there it goes.
Right.
I mean, it's satisfying in a way because that was building up for a while, but it's not surprising. Mm-hmm. Like, but when, and maybe it worked better when I was, like, it was surprising when I was a kid, like, to get back to Star Wars. But, like, when Han Solo shows up after shooting, he shows up as a surprise, and as a kid, I was totally surprised by him showing up again. I was like, I thought he was gone, but now he came back, and he helped Luke, oh my god, yeah! Like, and that being so near the end, being such a, like, when you're in that heightened state when the climactic action thing is happening, and then some character does an interesting thing you didn't know they were going to do, it's extra exciting because you're in this, like, you're on edge, you know? And you're easily fooled because you're 9.
I know in bad cases sometimes it feels like when you're playing a game where, like, the whole studio must have been just so tired because of how just, like, there's no emotion to anything that they're doing.
Because of the way the developers are tired, the players are tired, or the characters are tired?
Developers are tired. And I know some screenwriters try to do it where they'll structure out the film and then they'll write, like, the first third and then they'll write the ending after that because they want to be still jacked up on the story they've created and feel.
Oh, you never write like your first scene first and your last scene last, ever.
Right.
Really?
We always start with some level in the middle of the game. Like, let's start because we don't know what we're doing and do that. And if you and then you go back to the beginning and then you might make a mistake of doing your last scene last and then you're lucky if your end credits don't crash because you put so little time there.
I think that's a good part to end.
Speaking of this podcast. Speaking of low energy endings. Come on. Yeah.
So we'll close it out with, where can people find you on the internet, Tim and Jake?
Right here. I'm just Tim of Legend on Twitter.
And DoubleFine.com.
DoubleFine.com. Yep.
Where you can also play Massive Chalice.
Mm-hmm. We have some excellent writing. Did you guys introduce yourselves that way?
No.
Yeah, collusion. You should have. That's a conflict of interest that you should have explained right away that you guys did some excellent writing on that game.
Jake, talk something right now. Talk.
Well, we're at cardboardcomputer.com or on Twitter, cardboardcompy. At cardboardcompy.
And you also just joined Twitter.
I did. I just joined Twitter, yeah. And I'm at, my name is like hard to say out loud. It's _never_work. Never work.
And Kara is not on Twitter anymore, but her website is karaellison.co.uk. And this podcast is Script Blockcast on Twitter. And if you listen to this podcast and like it, please leave us a review on iTunes. I've never asked this before, but I'm asking now. That's it. Thank
I like
you for
it.
Coming on.
I'm going to go like it right now.
Great.
I'm
do
cool.
It.
Look how cool I am.
Be cool like Tim Schafer, everyone. And Jake, too. Jake is also really cool.
Yes. Super cool.
Do my best.